Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm glad that you can be here with me today as we go through the baseball card collection. We're rummaging through the big old monster box once again and pulling out a favorite player of mine, even though he's not extremely well known outside of the Southeast. You were definitely a fan of his if you watched Braves games on the old Superstation WTBS, back when that was the only place you could watch the Braves, because the Braves were typically so bad nobody else would clear their games. Talking about Glenn Hubbard, we've got a 1986 Topps card, card number 539. We'll look back at Glenn Hubbard's career. Best known for his fielding, certainly more his fielding than his hitting, but also really best remembered for a baseball card. Not this one, but another one, which still more than 30 years later has inspired a lot of baseball memories and memorabilia. We'll do that a little later on in the program, plus take a look back at the 86 top set, which is good but not great. Some people like it. I'm not a big fan of it, but it is still part of the memorable run of cards that Topps had in the mid-1980s. Not as good as some of the other sets that were made then, but you can definitely close your eyes and just imagine what an 86 Topps card looks like. It is a very memorable design, albeit not very good. But we'll look back at 86 Topps. But first, while I always say I'm glad that you are here with me, I'm glad I'm here with you after a little bit of a delay last week. Yeah, leave it to a hurricane named after an 85-year-old woman to wreak havoc on the state of Florida. Had a little Hurricane Irma interruption last week, and it was perfectly timed when I'm normally pulling together the podcast and posting it and also doing our weekend auction breaks. Yeah, that's when the storm very slowly crept its way towards Florida. It became pretty obvious that Florida was going to be impacted, I'd say even a week before it was. It was just a matter of exactly where was it going to impact. And for those of us living in the Tampa Bay area, how hard was it going to impact us? And for those who don't know, the Tampa Bay area has not had a direct hit by a hurricane since 1921. And when I say a direct hit, that means the eye of the storm hits the particular area. So the eye of the storm, or I would say the eye making landfall within 30 or 40 miles of Tampa, that hasn't happened in almost a century. And it's probably a good thing that it hasn't, but it's a bad thing too, because depending on what part of the hurricane you get, if you get the right side of the hurricane or the east side of the hurricane, that is where the most intense storms are, that is where the heaviest rainfall is, and that is also the way that Florida is built. If a hurricane goes right up the west coast and makes landfall around Tampa, that's also where the biggest storm surge is. And that is the biggest concern for those of us in Florida, because I would say probably 80% of the population of Florida lives within 20 miles of coastline. Now, there's a lot of people that live inland. There's a lot of large cities that are inland in Florida, but you know, it's Florida's beaches that draw most people here and have drawn people here ever since World War II. And as I mentioned, it's been, 96 years since Tampa's had a direct hit from a hurricane. Well, in 96 years, Florida's become a tourist destination. Florida has become a very affordable place to live. It's become a popular place to live thanks to the invention of air conditioning. It's become a comfortable place to live. So in 96 years, the population of Florida has grown tens of thousands of times with millions of people. A lot of people have built up on the water. They've built up within vicinity of the beaches and the rivers. And if you were to have a major storm come right up through Tampa, you would have 96 years of population growth under probably 15 feet of water. So obviously when a storm comes that close to us, we get a little concerned. And you know hurricanes are big deals if Floridians pay attention to them, because we get hurricanes all the time. And, you know, most of them are Category 1 or Category 2, and you just kind of go, okay, I guess better stock up on some canned goods. And then it blows through the state, and, you know, you cleaned up a few down branches and you move on. Well, this storm was a little different. It was very large. It was a Category 5 for much of its life in the Caribbean, and it was very unpredictable. It was either going to go right up the East Coast, it was going to go right up the West Coast, or as it turned out, it went right up the middle. And to make a long story short, we were going to ride out the storm in our house, which is just north of Tampa, but come Saturday morning, we saw that the track had shifted so far west, it looked like we were going to get the worst where we were. So we evacuated inland to where my parents live in Winter Haven, longtime spring training home for the Red Sox, later the Indians. And naturally, the storm shifted a little bit, so they got the brunt of the storm. But it all worked out. I was able to help my parents clean up their yard. There was no damage to their house. There was no damage to our house. And the state of Florida, well, other than the Keys, for the most part, was spared as the storm hit as a Category 4. It hit just south of Naples. But by the time it got inland, it just dispersed. It was an amazing feat where this Category 4 storm makes landfall, but then just very quickly dissipates into essentially a very high Category 1 or low Category 2, and then move through the state. Now, still, it caused quite a bit of damage. A lot of people were without power for days. My house was actually without power for, I think, 3.5 days. There are some people that are dealing with flooding still. And again, the Keys, that was tough to see some satellite imagery of the Keys, because a lot of areas that I've vacationed to down there around Big Pine Key, that area, Isla Mirada, were just absolutely hammered. So I'm very fortunate everything is okay here. The majority of people in West Central Florida are okay, but you still have people, again, dealing with flooding from the rivers. You've got people dealing with wind damage, especially down south near Naples, where the storm made landfall, and the poor Keys just got absolutely leveled, especially the western Keys between Key West and Isla Mirada. That just got hit really, really hard there. So I know you may have already made a contribution for Hurricane Harvey relief in Texas and Louisiana. If you get a few extra dollars, go ahead and make that donation for Hurricane Irma relief, primarily in Florida, as even though it was only Category 1 or 2 when it hit most of the state, a lot of damage was done, and there are a lot of people are still recovering. As for me, we're back on our feet. As for this podcast, back on our feet as well. Like I mentioned, we've got the 86 Topps car with Glenn Hubbard to talk about. Also, this upcoming weekend, we will start up our auction breaks once again, and we'll get back to the item that we were going to put up for bids last weekend, and that would be a couple of 83 Topps cello packs. So your chance to get, perhaps, a Ryan Sandberg or Tony Gwynn or Wade Boggs rookie card, or a second-year Cal Ripken Jr. card. We've had some pretty interesting breaks in the Wax Pack auctions, including a Cal Ripken second-year card from the 83 Fleer pack that we did a few weeks back. Of course, the biggest one that we've had, the Mark McGwire rookie card in the 85 Top Cello pack about 2 months ago. So if you want to participate in those, make sure you watch our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We'll post something probably Thursday and take bids through Saturday, doing the break on Monday morning via YouTube. We'll post the video. And also, we're back on track with our Flashback Friday episodes. This past Friday, we didn't go too far back in terms of podcasts. It was only about 6 months ago, but we did go way back in terms of the year, the make of the card, 57 Topps, the one 57 Topps card I had for a long time. And I bought it at a garage sale, and I've got a great story behind it, and that is Pee Wee Reese, as it's a pretty beat up card. It's a thoroughly beaten up card, but I was so happy. I bought it about 20 years ago. I was so happy to find this card because, like I said, it and I think maybe one other card, I only had a couple of 57 Topps cards for the longest time, but the Pee Wee Reese card was also the only Brooklyn Dodgers card that I have in my collection. Again, I don't have too much 1950s cards. I've picked up quite a few from 1959, but before then, I only have a handful of cards. But the Brooklyn Dodgers, I have a very good connection with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and that my father was a big Dodgers fan growing up in Brooklyn. And I share some stories about the Dodgers and also Dodger memorabilia. And the Brooklyn Dodgers are still very, very, very popular. And I think one of the reasons why there is an NBA team in Brooklyn, the Nets, who have been migrants throughout their history, starting out on Long Island, moving to New Jersey, and then moving to Brooklyn a few years ago. I think a big reason why the Brooklyn Nets are a team is because there's still an affinity for the Brooklyn Dodgers, a team that hasn't played in Brooklyn in 60 years now, but there is still a love for that team and a special love for the borough of Brooklyn. Even though the Brooklyn of 2017 is nowhere near the eclectic mixture of all sorts of, especially European backgrounds and the blue-collar work group that Brooklyn had 60 years ago. So give a listen to that. That was our Flashback Friday episode. If you don't see the link on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, you can find that episode and all of our archived episodes on audioboom.com or through several other platforms, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Blueberry. And that, of course, is where all of our new episodes end up every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. And please pass along the word about Wax Ecstatic, the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, and also the news that our new episodes drop Tuesday mornings at 10 Eastern. And we've got the Flashback Friday episodes on the weekends as well. And one final piece of housekeeping, just a reminder, your tips, your cash donations are always appreciated. Although again, this week, I wouldn't mind you sending your money to the Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Harvey relief efforts. But if you do have an extra couple dollars laying around and you like what you hear on this podcast and would like to support us, there are some production fees involved and, of course, time to make this podcast. We're not making a lot of money on this podcast. That was never the intention when the show started a little over a year ago. But we do appreciate your cash tips at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. Or if you are a Venmo person, you like Venmo over PayPal, we've got an option for you there as well. Venmo.com/waxecstatic. All right, as we dive into the big old monster box once again, I just pulled from a random row of cards here. 86 tops, and I have lots of 86 tops still in my collection. For a number of reasons. One, when I started collecting cards in 1989 and went full bore into the collecting hobby in 1990, there were still a lot of 86 Topps cards that were out there, even though it was 3-4 years later. And I've told the story before, but for those who are kind of new to the show, I was never very rich. I grew up and, my family was certainly able to take care of itself. But while we weren't rolling around in the dough, we certainly had enough to make ends meet and, have a little extra for fun things such as family vacations and the occasional extra discretionary money for things like baseball cards. And my parents were, let's just say, fiscally conservative. They didn't just hand money over to the kids. And even though that sucks when you're a kid, you want as much money as you can possibly get in your hands. I will say it really helped me appreciate the value of a dollar a lot more. And it's something that I've passed along to my kids. So, someday my kids will probably call me cheap. That's okay. But they're going to earn every dollar that they get because, as a child, I earned every dollar that I got. So whether it was a couple of dollars for doing weekly chores around the house or, as often was the case, it was around $15 to $20 for mowing the neighbor's yard every week. When I had money, I didn't have a whole bunch of money. So when I went shopping in 1989, 1990, even into 1991, I didn't necessarily buy the big dollar card. So, you know, Upper Deck packs were a luxury for me. And then once you got into 1991, when you're talking about, you know, the more premium Top Stadium Club and Leaf sets, and again, Upper Deck, and eventually Fleer Ultra comes around, I didn't buy those first. And when I did buy those, I didn't buy them in large quantities. I often stuck with the tried and true brands of Topps and Fleer and Donruss and Score that came around, and Bowman as well. And I would find two or three of the product lines each year that I really liked, and I would buy boxes of those. So that's how I allotted a lot of my money. Well, when I was first collecting, and I didn't quite have the money for boxes, I would just buy what was affordable. So that meant a lot of 89 Score, 88 Tops, and 86 Tops was in there as well. And 86 Tops, even though Tops never released the production numbers, that may have been the first year that they started going overboard with the production. I've often put the beginning of the quote-unquote junk wax era at 1988, because not only did you have that fourth property come in Score, and you would soon have Bowman and Upper Deck in 1989, but also, you know, those were the years that each property was printing out, you know, 2, 3, 4 million cards each. And that's, you know, 4 million of each card within a set. So you do the math. You take a 792 card set like Topps, multiply that by 4 million, and you can just imagine, you know, the billions of cards. I sound like Carl Sagan. Billions and billions of cards. You could just imagine the vast quantities of cardboard that were made and that are still readily available. And 86 Tops still is. So whether it was me being thrifty with my dollars, or as often was the case, if you bought a, you know, an assortment of cards, there was bound to be a stack of 86 Tops cards in there. Well, that's why my current stack of 86 Tops is what it is. But I didn't get rid of it. And, you know, that says something about the set. I think it also says just something about the timing of the set. And that is, you know, it is still kind of in this glory stretch of 1980s baseball cards. And even though 86 Tops is not as good as some of the other sets that were made just before and just after it, it is still very much part of the, I don't want to say classic baseball card, but still very much part of the conversation when you're talking pre-junk wax era. So even though Topps upped the production, even though there are plenty of cards still out there, and what really hampers the set is a lack of big rookie cards. Really, the big rookie cards in 86 Topps are Cecil Fielder and Darren Dalton. And that's pretty much it. Of course, Fielder and Dalton had very good careers, but it's not Boggs, it's not Gwynn, it's not Sandberg, it's not Ripken, or some more recent examples from the 84 and 85 sets. You didn't have Kirby Puckett, you didn't have Roger Clemens, you didn't have Don Mattingly, you didn't have Mark McGwire. You know, it was just very much a B-list group of rookies there. So, you know, the assortment of rookies, the design itself, even though it's a memorable design, it's not a great design. That kind of bogs down the set just a little bit. And, of course, context. And I've mentioned this before. With hindsight being 2020, collectors like or dislike a certain set, not only on the merits of the set itself, but because of the context of sets that were made right before or right after it. So many collectors kind of thumbed their nose at 86 Topps because Topps had such a great run of cards in 83, 84, and 85. Then you have the legendary 87 set right after it. So when you take a look at these five sets, 86 Topps is probably the least liked of those five sets. In fact, if I were to take a vending box of 500 cards each from 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87. I guarantee you, if I put those boxes out there in front of you and I said, hey, you have all five of these boxes, thumb through them, see what you can find. I guarantee you, the 86 Tops box is the last box that you open. In fact, you may not get around to opening that box until later down the line. You're going to go to 83 first. I know you are. Then you'll probably go to 85, then 87, then 84, or in an order very close to that. You may open three or four of those boxes that first day, but that last vending box, it's going to be 86 Tops. And you may just go, you know what, I'll get to this some other time. And then that box sits in another box for several weeks, if not months, before you finally have a rainy day or, you know, you're riding out a hurricane and the power goes out and you need something to do. You go, let me look at the 86 Tops set there. The 86 Tops design, like I said, it's not a great one, but it is very memorable in that it is very simple, deceptively simple. As we look at this Glenn Hubbard card number 539 from that set, and you've got the memorable white border along the bottom three quarters of the card, and then the top quarter has the black border. And, you know, it's a very nice little contrast there of black versus white. And then at the top, and I call this the Pac-Man font, and that's part of the reason why it does stand out. It does look a little bit like the Pac-Man people got their hands on the Topps design. You have the team name in these very large block letters, and the team name is colored in a scheme that is appropriate for the team. And the Braves are in this powder blue color, which is rather appropriate given the powder blue uniform that Glenn is wearing in this picture. And you would see blue used with other teams like the Toronto Blue Jays and the Kansas City Royals, the Cardinals, the Red Sox, they would have red. Houston Astros had orange. The Detroit Tigers actually had white. So, you know, the A's had green. So you had some kind of match with a primary color of the team uniform. And the color selection of the team name at the top of the card. Then at the bottom, in the exact same color, you had a little circle with the player's position, with the position written in black ink. You had the player's name across the bottom. And that was it. It was in many ways the reverse Polaroid design here, where Polaroid pictures, you used to have the thicker border at the bottom. That was so you could write, you know, whatever you wanted to on the picture, and then the thinner border at top. It's kind of like an upside down Polaroid where you have, you know, the thicker part is black and the thinner part is white. So even though it's a very simple design, again, compared to a lot of the other cards that were made around this time, it's a little plain. It's a little boring. So it doesn't really stand out. Now, the overall design, it does stand out. And like I said earlier in the show, if you closed your eyes, you can just picture what an 86 Topps card looks like. It is simple. It is very representative of the times, again, with a you know, Pac-Man type face, but also a very conservative look. Even though a lot of people remember the 80s as this wild and crazy decade, by 86, things were getting a little conservative in the country too, not just in politics, but business was starting to really rule the roost in the everyday vernacular of the country back then. 86 Topps, it does represent the time, but it does lack a little bit, not just in design, but in stars and rookies as well. Actually, stars it does pretty well, but rookies, as I mentioned, the class is a little shallow. Now, let's flip the card over. You'll notice this particular card, you don't really notice it on the front, but on the back, it has an attribute that is actually kind of unusual for 86 Topps cards, and that is it is miscut. This particular card, the centering on the back, is about 90-10 as it's shifting to the right just a little bit. And, you know, that was a very big common issue in the 1970s for Topps. But by 86, they had a pretty good handle on it. So this is a little bit of an outlier. But anyways, you still get the general feel of the backs of the 86 cards. And I've always marveled at the color selection for the back of the card, where it's a dark red around the border, a slightly lighter shade of red throughout the entire body of the back of the card with the black ink, kind of this New Jersey Devils look to it. I've been kind of mixed on the backs of these cards because it is a little hard to read the black on the red, But I thought it's a very unique selection of colors, especially because Topps had stuck with the dark green for many, many years. As I, you know, go back through my memory, you know, red was not a very dominant color on the backs of Topps cards, not since 1969. And, you know, that was less red, that was more pink, and you still had kind of a white text box where the stats were. So this was a very unusual choice for Topps in that they didn't typically use red as a color. It was typically green or maybe blue, but it was a very interesting choice, even though it is a little hard to read, and I think it's something that does stand out for this particular set. I'm not saying it's a great thing or it makes this set great, but it certainly makes the set unique. And it would eventually open the door for Topps to use red a little more on backs of cards. They would return to red with a red and black combination in 1989, and then kind of go back to a similar color combination, although a slightly lighter shade of red, almost pink, in 1991. And I prefer the backs of the 89s and the 91s more than the 86s, but this was an interesting turn of design, and it's still very simple, although it is kind of hard to read. So you have all this red and black, and you have kind of in a base shape. In the upper left-hand corner, you've got the card number. Upper right-hand corner, you've got the Topps logo. And in between, all of the personal information for the particular card. In this case, Glenn Hubbard. You've got his career Major League batting record. And Glenn Hubbard was not really known for his bat, no more for his gloves. So if space permitted, you had either interesting tidbits about the player that was featured on the front of the card, or you had what was called talking baseball. And you would have this, it was, you know, a cartoon character of a talking baseball and some kind of trivia question or trivia tidbit. Well, on Glenn Hubbard's card, you have some, you know, personal milestones. And let's be honest, offensive stats are far more interesting than defensive stats. But Glenn wasn't known for his bat. So Topps had to stretch here. They had just enough room for four little notes. But the first note is nothing about Glenn's bat. It's all about his first Topps card, naturally. In case you were wondering, you could scour the bargain bin of 79 Topps. Look for card number 715, an appropriate card number for an Atlanta Brave, and you will find Glenn's first Topps card. But you'll also find here dates for his first Major League home run, his first four-hit Major League game, and his first Major League Grand Slam. So again, 792 cards. Topps did not put out its best product in 1986, but this isn't one of those stay-away products. And this definitely falls into the category of you either like it or you don't. And I know quite a few people that love 86 Topps, and by all means, if you love that set, good for you. I mean, it's everybody has their favorites for a different reason, and as I've mentioned before, there is no wrong way of collecting baseball cards. There's no wrong set. Yeah, as much as I don't like 82 Fleer or 90 Donruss or you know, maybe 88 Topps, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't, you know, buy them. I'll tell you, don't, you know, waste your time collecting too many of these. But for some people, they have very personal connections to these particular sets. So if you like one set and I say I don't care for it, don't get upset. It's okay. 86 Topps is one of those sets, though, because it does lack the rookie star power. And because the design is a little compared to several other sets that were released by Topps during that time period, it does get a little bit of a bum rush. But because Topps made so many of them, there's a good chance for you to put together a nice set. So even though there aren't many blockbuster rookie cards in this particular set, you can still get those second-year Puckets and Clemens. You can still get the early career cards of Mattingly and Ripken and Boggs and Sandberg and Gwynn, and all those guys who became stars in the mid to late 70s or who started their career in the mid to late 70s who became stars in the early 1980s, you know, your Bretts, your Younts, your Molitors, and your, you know, longtime veterans, your Pete Roses, your Nolan Ryan said this is a pretty good set to collect. In fact, if you're a fan of Pete Rose, a Pete Rose baseball card timeline actually starts off the 86 Topps set. You've got Pete Rose's playing card as the number one card in the set, and then the next few cards in the set were kind of retrospective card cards, if you will, where, you know, Pete's 63, 64, 65, 66 Topps cards are on card number two. And then you've got 67, 68, 69, 70 on card three. So it was a very unique retrospective of not only Pete's career, but his legend in the hobby. And that, of course, is because just the year before, September 11th, 1985, Pete broke Ty Cobb's all-time hit record, 4,192 hits, Riverfront Stadium, against Eric Schau and the San Diego Padres. So if you're a fan of Pete Rose, I can tell you, you can get those cards very, very cheap. You know, the Rose player card may cost you a few dollars because with it being card number one, and still many young kids then not yet putting cards into plastic pages, still putting them into shoe boxes or wrapping rubber bands around them. Card number one in the set was still getting a little bit of abuse, but the first few cards of the 86 top set is a very neat tribute to Pete Rose, and you can get that very affordable. You know, you get all those cards collectively for under $10, depending on where you're buying them. So you got that neat little tribute to Pete Rose. You do have a couple of notable rookie cards in that set, but you're pretty much loaded down with a lot of star cards, early career cards for some great players throughout the 1980s and 90s, and many great veteran players as well. Some dating back, you know, who started their careers in the 1960s and early 70s. So nothing to sneeze at, but I will. So nothing to sneeze at here. It's just because it doesn't have the big rookie power of some of the earlier sets or the design. 86 Topps doesn't quite get the love it deserves, but this is a set that I would say don't trip over your feet to get. You can find plenty of common cards available pretty cheap. The star cards and rookie cards are pretty inexpensive. And, you know, if you do want to have some fun putting together a set, see if you can find a couple of boxes of 86 Topps vending boxes and put that set together. Or wax boxes. There's plenty of wax boxes and rack packs and cello packs from 1986. They're not as affordable as some of the cards from later in the decade, but still pretty affordable, especially compared to cards that were released earlier in the decade and that are a little more scarce or a little more in demand because of the cards that are featured in the set. So we've looked at 86 Topps. Let's take a look at the one Glenn Hubbard, who is featured on card number 539. It's so funny when you look back at the Atlanta Braves in the 1980s. They had that one great year in 1982 where they won the National League West. They would lose the NLCS to the eventual world champion Cardinals that year. But the Braves were a story of just futility. And the 82 team was that one shining light in a long stretch of futility. And you have to go back to 1969. That was the last time the Braves made the playoffs prior to 1982. They had a long stretch of just bad teams throughout the 1970s. You had Ted Turner buying the team, not because he was a baseball fan, but because he needed programming on his station, Channel 17 WTBS in Atlanta, Georgia. And he, you know, didn't really manage the team well. He actually tried to manage the team. He was actually in uniform in a game in Pittsburgh back in 1977, I believe it was. The baseball commissioner did not like that, however, and ever since then, a team owner cannot be a manager for a day. But, you know, he ran it with an iron fist, but the good thing was the Braves were so bad for so long, they were able to have some pretty high draft picks, but also they had a pretty good scouting system. And they made some key draft choices in the late 1970s. Most of the most key choice, if you will, is, of course, Dale Murphy. who was by far the star of the Braves for a long time, the face of the Braves for the longest of time. But Dale Murphy might have been the face of the Braves, but he wasn't the face of the Braves fan. I would have to say Glenn Hubbard is probably the face of the Braves fan. Even though he wasn't from Atlanta or the Southeast, he just had this good old boy look to him. And I think that was one reason why Braves fans were endeared to him. Of course, Bob Horner was another big name from that time. Horner was definitely known more for his bat than his glove, where Hubbard was the other way around. And Horner also had kind of that good old boy look for many, many years. So even though Dale Murphy was the undisputed star of the Atlanta Braves throughout the late 70s and throughout the 1980s, the face of the Braves fan, I think you found that in Bob Horner and certainly Glenn Hubbard. Now, Hubbard was actually born in Germany. His dad was in the Air Force, so Hubbard was an Air Force brat. He hopped and skipped and jumped around like many other Air Force brats do. He was able to rise to prominence as a high school baseball player, first in California, later in Utah, again, just following wherever his dad was stationed. And he was a 20th round selection of the Atlanta Braves back in 1975. So I've often said, it's easy to pick those star players when you're a bad team and you've got a top five pick in the first round. You're supposed to pick a future star player. You're supposed to pick a cornerstone who's going to be a big part of your organization for 8, 10, 12 years, maybe longer if you don't lose them to free agency. So it's easy to do that, but to find a diamond in the rough in the 20th round of a draft is pretty darn good. So as much as we joke about the Braves being a futility team for many, many years, they did manage to have that decent selection along the way, and they certainly found one in Glenn Hubbard in 1975. He very quickly moved through the Braves organization, and that again is a testament to just how bad the Braves were. Hubbard was good enough to move up the pipeline very quickly, but by the time he was 20 years old when he made his major league debut in 1978, he was already better than whatever the Braves had in journeyman veteran playing second base, in the late 1970s. So he very quickly moves up the ladder, doesn't really become a regular player until the 1980 season, but he was already starting to make his mark on the defensive side. Like I said, batting average, he was basically a career 250 hitter. In fact, the official number is a 244. But he was extremely consistent in the field. Wasn't flashy by any stretch of the imagination, but you could always count on Glenn Hubbard. If there was a ball that went up the middle, depending on who his shortstop was, and for many years it was Rafael Ramirez, but it could be any number of players, whoever the shortstop was, or often a third base, you know, if you're looking at a double play that's going around the horn, and Bob Horner was often at third base during those years that Hubbard was in Atlanta, you knew that Glenn Hubbard was going to be firmly planted on second base to turn that double play. And what made Hubbard unique was how he turned these double plays. You know, now you look at double plays, it is routine. You know, when the ball is coming in from the left side of the infield, the second baseman is darting over towards the bag. He receives the ball very quickly, you know, taps a foot on the base, and then goes airborne slightly. We're not talking like, Walt Weiss used to. Of course, Weiss was a shortstop. But, you know, Walt Weiss would get major air when he was turning a double play. But, you know, most second basemen, they're going to, you know, get a little bit of elevation when turning a double play because they don't want to get run over by the base runner. Now, rules have changed, too, to where you can't allow yourself to get run over by a runner. That's the Chase Utley rule from a couple years ago. So, you know, baseball rules have changed a little bit, but the habit is still there where once that second baseman fields that ball, he's just going to very lightly step on or tap the base and then get a little bit of air as he wheels around to chuck the ball over to first base. Well, Hubbard stood in there. You know, there was no getting air with Glenn Hubbard. And it's not like Glenn Hubbard was built like a tank. You know, this guy was you know, 5'9", 150 pounds. He was your prototypical sized second baseman. But he was a guy who would stand his ground. And it wasn't like he was bowled over. He was just very confident that he could make that play, get that throw across to first base, and not get plowed over in the process. He was so consistent at turning double plays, he actually led the National League in turning of double plays at second base three times in his career. He was top 10 six times in his career. So even though the Braves were overall during Glenn's time, they're not a great team. And even though he was not flashy with the glove, he was never a Gold Glove winner. He was very consistent. You could always count on him. And he was one of the few consistent bright spots for the team throughout the 1980s. The Braves did not have really good pitching at that time. Once you got past Murphy and Hubbard, Horner, I should say, the offense dropped down significantly, especially in power. You know, you had Chris Chambliss for a few years there. You had a few other players that had a little pop in their bat, but, you know, they never had the really dominant offensive lineup that other teams in the National League had back then. So even though there was a lack in pitching, especially starting pitching, you know, they actually had some pretty good relievers over the years. But even though starting pitching was lacking, even though the offensive talent, especially power, would drop off after the top two or three players, defensively, the Braves were pretty solid up the middle, thanks in part to Glenn Hubbard consistently being able to deliver at second base. Now, he was honored for not only his defensive contributions, but his offensive contributions as well in 1983. That was the year he hit .263, his second best batting average, second only to 1987, where he hit .264. But he also hit 12 home runs, 70 RBI that year. And he got a base hit in the 1983 All-Star game as he was able to knock one off of Cal Ripken. Cal Ripken Jr. was actually making his first All-Star start at Comiskey Park in 1983, but Comiskey Park's infield, notoriously awful, very rock solid, and that was in part due to years of maintenance by the grounds crew for the Go-Go Sox to try to, you know, pound that dirt into the ground and make it a hard surface for the runners to run on, but also it was just not spectacularly maintained throughout the year. So Ripken eats the ball on a tough hop, and Hubbard would get a base hit in that game there. So that's his one and only All-Star season, but that is not his one and only moment in the sun, as he provided some key hits in the 1982 playoff run, especially against the San Diego Padres. The Braves and the Padres, I don't think a lot of baseball fans realize now how intense the Braves and Padres rivalry was in the early to mid-80s. When you think of baseball rivalries, you think Red Sox-Yankees, you think Dodgers-Giants, maybe Cubs-White Sox, even though, you know, now they actually play each other in interleague baseball. But, you know, Cardinals-Cubs, Cubs-Mets, I mean, there's different rivalries. You don't think Braves-Padres, but that was a pretty big rivalry back in the early 80s as both teams were on the rise. And the Braves would come out on top in 82. The Padres would come out on top in 84. And there were some pretty intense games and brawls as well between these two teams. A lot of people forget that the Braves and Padres were in the National League West for 25 years. It's the strangest thing how Atlanta ended up in the West, but that's because the Cardinals and the Cubs didn't want their rivalry split when baseball went into divisions in 1969. And naturally, because of that, the Mets and the Cubs created a rivalry. But they were in the same division. The Braves and the Padres were in the West. And in the early 80s, you know, the Braves, the Padres, and the Dodgers were the teams to beat. And you had some pretty intense series between those three teams, but especially the Braves and Padres during those years. So Hubbard was a key part of the Braves' playoff run in 1982. Again, was one of the most consistent players. And even though we knock him for his batting average, still a career .244. mean, that's pretty average for a lot of middle infielders. You know, most teams, you build the middle of your infield, and, you know, even your center fielder, your catcher, you're looking for defensive prowess over offensive, power that you may have. So, you know, Hubbard was a key part to the Braves throughout the 1980s. But as John Schuerholz takes over the team, as the Braves start, again, rebuilding for what would turn out to be an incredible run of success throughout the 1990s and the early 2000s, Hubbard was eventually moved. You know, after the 1987 season, he was turning 30 years old, and the Braves decide to let him go. And the Braves are bringing in a whole different crop of middle infielders by this time. You've got Mark Lemke making his way up. You've got Jeff Blauser and several others who would fulfill that role. So they just cut him loose at the end of the 1987 season. He latches on with the Oakland Athletics in 1988. Appears in 105 games. .255 batting average, was also part of that A's team that lost to the Dodgers in the 88 World Series. And he was part of the A's team in 1989, but was being very sparingly used. Of course, the A's had some better younger options in the middle infield at that time, including Tony Phillips. You had Mike Gallego, and Walt Weiss as well was making his way up there. So in the middle of the 89 season, he gets released despite appearing in 53 games and doing okay while there. He gets released in the middle of the 89 season and is not picked up by anybody. And it's just tough timing because the A's, of course, would go on to sweep the Giants for their world championship in 89. And the career of Glenn Hubbard would come to a very quiet end. 12-year career, 1,354 games, 1,084 hits, but a career fielding percentage. I know some fans aren't big on fielding percentage, but I'll just throw this number out there. Career fielding percentage of .983%, which is a pretty solid number. It doesn't tell the complete story. I know for those of you who are big on sabermetrics and other datum that will show you how good of a fielder you are. But still, if you just look at that general stat that's been around for a long time, it shows that he was a pretty consistent infielder and one of the few consistent parts of the Atlanta Braves throughout a very inconsistent decade. One where the decade started with them being bottom feeders, eventually ended up with them, you know, being division winners, and then again being bottom feeders by the time his time in Atlanta was done. Now, his playing career in Atlanta was done in 87, his playing career in Major League Baseball done in 89, but he would go back to the Braves organization in 1990, and he would be a part of the organization's growth of youngsters. He was a minor league coach throughout the 1990s. He would be a major league coach under Bobby Cox in the 2000s. And then when Freddie Gonzalez took over as manager in 2010, he was unceremoniously cut by the team. And he latched on with the Kansas City Royals organization, first as a roving minor league instructor, but then as the bench coach for the minor league team in Lexington, Kentucky, a Class A team called the Lexington Legends. And this is where the legend of Glenn Hubbard and a baseball card continues to this day. This particular card, 86 tops, well, it's a nice card. It is not Glenn Hubbard's most infamous baseball card. Rather, his 84 Fleer card is best remembered. And that is because that is the card where Glenn Hubbard, wearing this same powder blue Atlanta Braves road uniform, he is at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia. There's a whole group of mascots behind him, including the Philly Fanatic. And here's Glenn Hubbard with a boa constrictor wrapped around his shoulders. Now, we're not talking about those little, 2-foot, 3-foot snakes that are brought to show and tell by the, Parks Department. Now, this is a massive snake that is just draped around him. Think Britney Spears at the VMAs back in 2001. I mean, this is something that should be in a zoo. And why Glenn Hubbard is wearing a snake in Philadelphia in presumably 1983, nobody is really sure. In fact, there's really no clear-cut story as to why this picture was taken or what he was doing with a snake or what does the snake mean. nobody really knows. But that card is still legendary, and it's actually one of the goofy cards that you find in the 84 Fleer set. Another one is Jay Johnstone wearing a Budweiser umbrella hat. You know, Fleer, even though it had this very business-like look in the mid-80s, they had a lot of fun with some of the pictures that they took. And Glenn Hubbard is certainly no different, as, you know, he had this giant snake wrapped around his shoulders. Well, the Lexington Legends back in 2016 held a Glenn Hubbard bobblehead night. And this isn't just your average, well, it's just, you know, put this little ceramic bobblehead out to the first 500 fans or whatever. This is a great bobblehead because it features Glenn Hubbard with a snake around his shoulders. And my personal favorite, as if the snake around Glenn Hubbard wasn't cool enough, they also replicate the bushy beard that he's known for from the 1980s with this, you know, real scruffy beard. It's not just painted on ceramic. It's actual, you know, they found some, I don't know, camel hair or something. And you've got this really scruffy Glenn Hubbard circa 1983, although I think he's wearing the Lexington uniform. But it's a tremendous bobblehead that came out in 2016 as definitely a collector's item. One last thought about Glenn Hubbard and the Atlanta Braves from this time. The road uniform that is seen in that 84 Fleer card and this 86 Topps card, one of my favorites, and I was never an Atlanta Braves fan. I was exposed to the Braves a lot growing up in Florida. You know, you had, and remember, prior to 1990, when the ESPN TV package came out, where you had Sunday Night Baseball and Wednesday Night Baseball, you know, back then you only had the Saturday game of the week on NBC, and prior to that, Monday Night Baseball on ABC. You only had a couple of national games that were shown. And being here in Tampa, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, we didn't have a baseball team. So the only consistent baseball that you had fed to you was the Cubs on WGN, the Mets on WOR, and the Braves on WTBS. So we saw the Braves quite a bit, and even though I was never really a Braves fan, I was just exposed to them year after year after year after year. But as time has gone on, I've really appreciated the Braves jersey from the early 80s, so much so that I finally went out and bought one, a replica. It's a Dale Murphy jersey, but the jersey that they wore from 1981 through 86, which you see pictured on this card here, it is just a beautiful powder blue. And, you know, some teams, they made the powder blue work, and others, it didn't look too good. But the Braves, it worked. And the script Atlanta, the powder blue hat that they had at the time, which was actually the color scheme of my high school baseball team. I went to Armwood High School just outside of Tampa. And back when I was there in the early to mid 90s, they went with the Brave color scheme from the mid 80s, which is kind of neat. You know, there's a little extra meaning to that for me. But I absolutely love this Braves uniform. It's just got a classic look to it. It's a very simple look. And it reminds you of that great team that Joe Torre was able to pull together in 1982 to appear in the playoffs. And the not-so-great teams that would more often than not show up. Yeah, you know, especially by 85 and 86, the Braves were starting to hit rock bottom again. But, you know, it's reminiscent of those teams that had some battles with the Padres and battles with the Dodgers. But it's also very reminiscent of a lot of really good players who don't quite get the respect they deserve because they were on a team that was typically, you know, finishing fifth or sixth in the division, 96 losses a year. So Dale Murphy doesn't get the respect that he deserves, you know, certainly outside of Atlanta. And Bob Horner doesn't get the respect that he deserves. And Glenn Hubbard doesn't get the respect that he deserves, because Glenn Hubbard, like I've said before, was one of the few consistent players, one of the few consistent pieces of a Braves team that was very inconsistent. So even though the Atlanta jersey that I have says Murphy and three on the back, it is not all that hard to close your eyes and imagine, you know, maybe I can get another one like this that has Hubbard and 17 on it. And by the way, that's probably another reason why Glenn Hubbard was so liked by Ted Turner, because TBS was on Channel 17 in Atlanta, you know, before it became a superstation. So I don't know, maybe some brownie points there for Glenn Hubbard. But a longtime member of the Braves, first as a player, next as a minor league coach. And even though he's not with the organization, an organization he spent 39 years with, he is still best remembered for his time in Atlanta, and often remembered for that time he had a snake around his shoulders. Why? We're not exactly sure. But it's Glenn Hubbard. It's card number 539 from the good but not great 86 top set. You know, all this talk about jerseys, one of these days I'm just going to have to do a show about jerseys. I do have a few that I've kept, and maybe we can go through that. We'll put that in the memorabilia tab. But first, we'll do a few more shows from the big old monster box. So join us next Tuesday, 10 a.m. Eastern. We'll pick out another card from sometime in the early to mid 80s, and we'll talk about the card design. We'll talk about the player as well. Again, thanks for everybody who had some kind of concern about me and my family from this past hurricane. Again, we're doing fine. No damage to the house other than a few stressful days. We're going to be okay, and we're back in business. Like I said, we've got the new episodes on Tuesday, Flashback Friday episodes. The wax breaks will be happening. The auctions will be happening this upcoming weekend as well. So we're swinging back into things. And normally at this time, I would include some commentary from the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed, but we're almost out of time. The show's run for almost an hour here, so we're going to wrap things up here. So get the conversation going again at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Let us know your thoughts about Glenn Hubbard, the Atlanta Braves in the 1980s, the 86 top set, or anything that's on your mind, and we will share your comments in our next show. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.